Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And by Antioch University New England, offering doctoral degrees in clinical psychology, environmental studies, and marriage and family therapy, as well as master's degrees and certificates. antioch.edu/nhradio.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. A new report predicts a staggering increase in deaths from drugs, alcohol, and suicide if current trends continue. The report is by two national public health trusts. It's called Pain in the Nation. It predicts an epidemic of Americans dying from these three causes over the next decade. And New Hampshire, it says, will see the fourth largest increase among all the states. The authors call on the country to adopt a national resilience strategy to avoid this fate. And today in Exchange, we ask what that would look like. Also, barriers to getting it done here in the Granite State. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have three guests in studio. Ann Douglas is here, community educator and prevention specialist for NAMI NH, the New Hampshire chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And Ann, it's good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us, Derek Hughes, a volunteer for NAMI's In Our Own Voices speaker series. Derek has been in recovery since 2007. And Derek, it's really good to meet you too. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
And also with us, Tim Rourke, Director of Substance Use Disorders Grantmaking for the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation. Tim is also chair of the Governor's Commission on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Prevention, Treatment and Recovery. And Tim, a big welcome back. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Laura.
And all of you joining us from D.C. is John Auerbach. He's president and CEO of the Trust for America's Health. That's a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization focused on disease prevention. And John's group is one of the two that released this report that I mentioned. And John, good to have you too. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
So, John, lots of numbers, lots of information in this study. What's the one thing you really want people to pull from it?
The most important lesson here, I think, is that the numbers are staggeringly high. More than 1 million people have died from drugs, alcohol, and suicide over the last decade, and that those numbers in the next decade could rise to as many as 1.6 million. But the other message is this is preventable. There are action steps that can be taken now that will significantly reduce those deaths, but it requires a comprehensive approach.
Well, and I think you were quoted as saying, John, staggering, tragic, and preventable, and maybe tragic because these are preventable, right?
Indeed. Indeed. There are, our report highlights scores of evidence-based policies that we know can be effective in terms of preventing these deaths.
Well, unfortunately, New Hampshire is among the states, your report predicts, John, could see the biggest increases in deaths from substance abuse, from suicide. Why do you think that is, John?
I'm not as well informed as your other guests with regard to the specifics with New Hampshire. I think in terms of the projections for the future, they're based in large part on looking at the significant number of deaths from drug overdoses at this point, which in 2015 ranked New Hampshire as the second highest in the country. So when you have that level of suffering already, unless there are dramatic attempts to try to address the issue. You're building on a base of already a problematic situation.
Yeah, that's interesting. So it's largely because of the opioid crisis that New Hampshire is up there in terms of your predictions, John.
It's much higher in terms of its ranking than alcohol-induced death rates or suicide death rates, but those are troubling as well.
Well, and let's talk briefly, John, about some of the solutions your report calls for, and then we'll spend the rest of the hour with our New Hampshire guests for sure going through these. But at the national level, you've been quoted, John, as saying that solutions must go way beyond reducing the supply of opioids, other drugs, and alcohol. What are you trying to say there?
Our overall message is that there isn't one or two single approaches that if we adopted them would be effective in terms of having a statistically significant reduction on these deaths. What we need is what we call a resiliency strategy that incorporates a comprehensive approach. That approach would include looking at changing the healthcare delivery system so that it's much more incorporating behavioral health into the delivery of primary care, screening people, and then quickly referring them to the appropriate services without barriers. It also would mean paying a lot of attention to what we think of as upstream, working with children and families so that children from the earliest ages begin to develop the approaches that will help them in terms of pressures in later life that might lead to substance use, suicide, or alcohol use. And that can include school-based strategies as well as services for families. And then the third main category of approaches that we would say needs attention are to the conditions in people's lives that create unusual pressures that sometimes lead them to these diagnoses, and those pressures can be economic pressures, it can be domestic violence, it can be job loss. Paying attention to those situations in people's lives that are creating enormous pressures and a sense of hopelessness and despair.
Well, and another question on this resiliency strategy that you mentioned, and you're talking about a lot of the approaches that are often discussed, you know, prevention, treatment for substance abuse, mental illness, pain. Is there anything new that you think the country should be doing, John, in terms of this resilience strategy? Or are you more calling for, you know, an amped up approach of current efforts?
The efforts that have received the most attention and support so far are the important ones related to opioid prescribing, overdose prevention, and access to treatment. Those are all very important. But we believe that it's necessary for us also to be thinking about prevention. And prevention doesn't simply apply to when someone has already developed an addiction. It means creating conditions in people's lives, beginning in childhood, where it's less likely that they're going to be vulnerable towards the use of drugs, alcohol, or the consideration of suicide. So moving to that prevention approach and to thinking about what can we do in terms of building resiliency, building strong families, building the strengths in individuals is what we think has been missing so far from much of the discussion.
Interesting. So more upfront work, more thinking about resiliency, strong families, strong communities, and so forth. A huge task, John, much harder than, you know, assigning a new outfit of law enforcement to stop opioids at the border.
Indeed. I think we much prefer approaches that are simple and there's one thing you can do. There's a vaccine. There's one approach that works. These three diagnoses are not those kinds of medical conditions. They're ones that require comprehensive approaches and many different sectors all working together to try to reduce the conditions that lead to this situation.
Well, John, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That's John Auerbach, again, president and CEO of the Trust for America's Health, a nonprofit organization, one of two that released this report that we're looking at. Again, a new national study includes alarming predictions for New Hampshire, drawing a strong connection between substance abuse and suicide. and saying that the Granite State will have among the country's highest suicide risks in the upcoming decade. This hour, we're getting more details, also local reaction to this report, and ideas for what John called a resilience strategy. You can join us with your comments, questions, and, of course, personal experiences. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Well, Derek, Ann, and Tim, I just love, first of all, your broad thoughts on what we heard from John and Tim. Also, just this report, especially why New Hampshire? I mean, the predictions, again, that New Hampshire will have the fourth biggest increase in terms of deaths from suicide, drug and alcohol abuse is pretty staggering.
It is. You know, and I have to give John and his organization's credit for putting together this really phenomenal report. You know, obviously, these issues are not new to New Hampshire. And, you know, while we've been talking about the opioid epidemic sort of taking center stage alongside its sort of sister disorder, our state's mental health crisis, you know, I'll go back to one of the points that they also raised, which was around alcohol. We have historically had incredibly high rates of consumption of alcohol and the overconsumption of alcohol in New Hampshire, disproportionate to other states. So to see a report that suggests that these issues, when taken together, could potentially lead to that level of increase isn't surprising when you look back over the high rates of other substance misuse and other risk behaviors we've had sort of simmering in the background of our current dialogue for many, many years.
And what do you think is important about this? What does it tell us that we don't already know? As Tim and John mentioned, we've been talking about this for a long time.
First of all, I just want to say I was so excited to read this study. Because what it does is it really talks about all three of these incredibly tragic outcomes as despair deaths. And I truly believe that we need to bring hope and belief in early intervention and treatment and recovery. So I really like the idea of the National Resilience Strategy. I think that those of us who have been working in the larger field of behavioral health for many decades now, I think we understand this better than anybody, because the bottom line is for us to collaborate and communicate across systems and across communities, not just in our state, but across the country.
Well, and that's the way to put it, despair deaths. And that's why John, I think, says it's so tragic, because these are largely preventable.
They are. And the other thing I would say about all of these types of issues is that stigma is an underlier for all of them. It really impacts people from accessing care. It impacts the dollars that go to that care. So I really think that with this study, I think it can help to address these issues better than each one in isolation.
So, Derek, let's hear your story, because it involves all three of these issues, alcohol, drugs, a suicide attempt. And again, thank you so much for being here and sharing your story.
Oh, you're welcome.
Can you just tell us, Derek, when you first started to feel, you know, mentally unwell? You know, I just don't feel right.
Oh, boy. It started around the age of 13 for
me.
Wow,
young.
Yeah. When I was 13 years old, I started to have a feeling of disconnect from, you know, the kids at school and from my parents. And I was feeling like people weren't listening to what I was trying to communicate to them. And, you know, I was diagnosed with all sorts of different diagnoses at that age, ADHD and all these things. And none of them seemed to fit. You know, it's like they couldn't put a finger on what was going on with me. And when I was 16 years old, I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And the effect of that in my life was huge, because I had finally discovered what was going on with me, and it seemed to really explain everything that was going on in my life. But it, you know, that knowledge didn't really help, you know, me feeling any more comfortable in my skin than I was.
Even though you sort of knew what it was.
Exactly.
So you started to self-medicate.
Exactly.
Drugs and alcohol.
Yep. So I started smoking marijuana early on, probably around 13, 14 years old.
Wow, it's young.
Yeah, I was just dabbling in it at that point. But as I got older, my marijuana and alcohol use increased. I started pretty much doing anything I could get my hands on, pills, cocaine, And when I was 18 years old, I started doing methamphetamines. And the reason I was doing that particular, you know, what they call uppers, is because when you have bipolar disorder, it's a disorder where sometimes you feel like you're really up in the sky, and the next thing you know, you're on the ground crumbling and your life is falling apart. And what would happen is my medication, you know, me medicating that was to stay up, you know, as long as I could without having to crash. And what it did to my life was created complete chaos. And I did these drugs probably until I was around 24 years old. And I was living in New Orleans at the time. And in New Orleans, drugs were very cheap. And they were easy to come by. And it was something that I was doing increasingly more and more as I got more and more depressed in my life. As I was feeling more disconnected from people, I was doing more and more drugs. And at the age of 24, I overdosed from methamphetamines. I had been on a binge, and I ended up having a seizure and was in the hospital. They put me through detox. Basically, it wasn't really a medical detox, more or less just coming off the drugs with the support of other people. And I did that, and I decided that I wasn't going to do drugs anymore. I had figured I'm going to do this on my own, and it didn't really work.
When you say do this on my own, you mean sort of deal with your mental illness
exactly.
on your own.
Exactly. And I realized I
it's
couldn't.
It's funny now, right? I mean,
it is.
To think that you could manage bipolar
it is.
By yourself.
But I couldn't really, you know, it wasn't possible. So after Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans in 2005, I ended up moving back to New Hampshire with my family. And I was doing, you know, at that point I was still doing cocaine. I was doing crack. And I woke up one morning and I looked around my apartment, and there were random people sleeping all over my apartment. My place was trashed. I was filthy. And I just had this kind of like moment where I realized my life is going absolutely nowhere. And I, at that moment, I realized, okay, I need to do something. And the first thing that popped in my head was, I want to end my life. And I got in the car, drove off into the woods. I got out into the woods, and I had the intent of ending my life. And at that point, I stopped the car, and well, the car actually died. I didn't stop it. It died. And
it broke down.
It broke down. And when it broke down, I was stuck out in the woods, broke down. So I called AAA. They came and picked me up.
You didn't call a suicide hotline.
No,
you called AAA.
Exactly. And I ended up going to the hospital that night. And I walked in and I said, you know, I'm a drug addict. I need help. And that's when they basically said, well, we have no beds available. It'll be a few days. We can't keep you, so we're going to have to send you home. And I was petrified. I did not want to go home. That was the worst thing I could possibly do, was to go home, because I knew if I go home, I'm going to end up using again.
Well, and it's impressive that you had the wherewithal to at least know that.
Exactly.
No, I can't do that. That is not a good option for
Absolutely.
Me.
Absolutely. And that was my, you know, I had, you know, I believe God was playing a huge role in my life at that time, because, you know, I had this voice in my head telling me, if you go home, you're going to use and you're probably going to die.
So don't.
Yeah. And so they gave me a pamphlet for Alcoholics Anonymous. At the time where I was living, there was no Narcotics Anonymous programs. So Alcoholics Anonymous is one of the biggest, you know, programs there are. And I ended up going to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting that morning. And, you know,
I'm going to let you finish up after
sure.
a short break, because I have to jump in here anyway.
Absolutely.
And we're going to hear the end of that story.
Sure.
And then how it relates to this study that we're talking about, you know, looking at New Hampshire, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, mental illness, and this sort of trifecta that, again, this report says it's a problem now and it's going to be even a bigger problem in the near future. So we'll finish up that story and we'll start taking your calls and emails as well. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Creative process isn't always easy, but getting distracted can be.
It feels like you're writing, but it's the equivalent of empty calories.
If you're looking, I have to write 500 words a day, it's not on Twitter. The 10-Minute Writer's Workshop, your source for the productive habits we can all benefit from, along with the guilty pleasures we can all relate to. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, a new national study includes alarming predictions for New Hampshire. The report draws a strong connection between substance abuse and suicide and says the Granite State will have among the country's highest suicide risks and among the country's largest increases in deaths from suicide, drugs, and alcohol. Pretty sobering stuff today in The Exchange, but it also calls for a resilience strategy. And a little bit later, we'll talk about what that might look like. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. What are your thoughts and reactions to this report? What do you think a resilience strategy should include? Again, we'd love to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Derek Hughes, just before the break, you were finishing up your amazing story. You told us how you had mental illness early in your teens, how you self-medicated like so many people do when they can't find proper treatment, and you know, reached a low point, considered suicide, ended up in the hospital instead. They didn't have room for you, but they did give you an AA brochure, and you went to a church and attended a meeting. And from there, the story starts to go up, Derek.
Right. So I went to a meeting that morning, and I remember going in, and I don't remember anything that was said, but there were a couple men that came and introduced themselves to me. And after telling them what was going on, they basically said, okay, well, we'll come back to your house and help you get rid of everything. So they came back to my house. We got rid of the alcohol, dumped it all down the toilet. Whatever drugs I had left, got rid of those. And, you know, I was safe for the night. And I went to bed that night. And the next day I woke up and I got a phone call from one of the men from AA. And he said that, I think we can get you a bed down at the Phoenix House in Keene. And the Phoenix House is a 30-day program for people with drug and alcohol problems. And so I went to the Phoenix House, went through the 30-day program, and went back home. And, you know,
that's a vulnerable time, isn't it?
It was. It was incredibly
when you're coming
vulnerable.
Out of treatment, you know, you think, ta-da, I'm done, and it turns out you're not.
Yeah, no, definitely not. One of the biggest problems with coming out of a program like that and then coming back into the real world is you still have that disconnect from people, and you're still dealing with your mental illness, except now it's like an open scab. You know, you have all this, you know, you're more susceptible to the outside world and everything that kind of surrounds that. And then also you've got people that you hung out with for the last few years that, you know, still want to suck you into that life. And it's hard to stay away from the negativity, but that's one of the most important things, is staying away from the negativity. And that's something that I had to learn really quick. So I ended up, at that point, I was going to 3 meetings a day, and I basically dedicated my life to the program, to the 12 steps. And by doing that, I was able to, you know, find my way in life. And the biggest thing was going to a mental health facility where they treat, they have a psychiatrist, they have therapists, they have case managers, people that can help you understand your illness and treat it. And I was able to get on a medication, and the medication I was able to get on is something that's injectable. It's a monthly injection. Now, not all medications have this, but the one that I'm particularly on is an injection that I get once a month where I don't have to mess with pills or anything like that. So the temptation is not there for me. and I'm able to take that medication and have stability in my life. And I've been on it now for quite a few years, and it really works.
Well, so a bunch of questions, and I want to ask Tim and Ann too. But here's a big one for you, Derek. How were you able to pay for the 30 days at Phoenix House and this ongoing treatment?
Sure. So the 30 days at Phoenix House, surprisingly enough, a friend of mine helped pay for that. And not everyone has that, so I understand that. But, you know, there are people that would rather see you in treatment than rather see you on the street. And I think for a lot of people, instead of saying, oh, there's no hope, you know, I think we can keep our mind open. And there are programs, there are different options for people who want to get treatment. But one of the biggest problems that I found is that you know, especially when I was going to the hospital and trying to get a bed, there's an infrastructure for people with mental illness to get help pretty quickly, but there's no infrastructure for people with drug addiction to get help quickly. And that's one of the biggest problems we're facing here in New Hampshire, is that there's so many people that need help but can't get it because there is no infrastructure for those people.
Well, and let's talk about that. And it seems so obvious, you know, Anne, that as Derek told us, you know, mental illness is connected to, can be connected to drug abuse, can be connected to alcohol abuse. How much siloing do you still see going on when it comes to these three issues?
A lot of siloing happens. And I think it happens from a national level down, because when you're applying, when states and communities are applying for grants, oftentimes the benchmarks and the deliverables of those grants are focused on either substance use, either mental health, or suicide risk, but not often across all three issues. So
why is that?
I think I'd defer to Tim on this one. I think it really is a mindset in our country where we are in silos addressing these issues, and that's what's so fantastic about this National Resilience Strategy.
Right, the tragedy deaths, or despair deaths, I think.
Absolutely.
You called it. And, you know, it makes so much sense. I mean, you hear Derek talk, Tim, and, you know, when people have mental illness, especially at a young age, you know, of course they often self-medicate, as Derek did. I mean, you hear his story and you go, yes, I'm sure I can understand why people do that. So why do we silo it and, you know, fund this but not that and separate this out from that?
You know, I think it is almost generational, almost cultural in its history, going back to the early days of when we shut down the country's institutionalized mental health system, the goal being that we wanted to it was inappropriate to put people in residential facilities who did not need intensive lifelong care in a residential home. They could be treated, find recovery in the community. And then we shut down those hospitals all across the United States, and the resources did not come into the communities to provide those necessary support services. We talk about that history very specific to mental illness. However, going back in the days when that was done, there was something called the IMD exclusion, which was an attempt by Congress to limit the ability to backtrack into an environment where we were just institutionalizing people with mental illness. And I will use the example there where the IMD exclusion limits, for a long time, limited the number of beds a facility who took Medicaid could have. If you had more than 16 beds, you couldn't bill Medicaid. The idea being, if there's going to be residential treatment, we need to keep it small. That exclusion not only impacted the mental health system for very valid reasons, because we used to put people away who had mental illness and just leave them there, but it also impacted substance use. And if you go back and look, and it's become a problem in as we've worked to build residential addiction services, and fortunately there's been efforts both nationally and in New Hampshire to remove that exclusion and allow us to build capacity within organizations that can treat a larger volume of people. But I mention it because if you go back and you look at the congressional notes around the testimony when that bill was created, you saw a lot of information that was actually not just stigma about mental illness and substance abuse, but the mental health community stigmatizing people with addiction as something different, people with a primary substance abuse diagnosis suggesting perhaps some stigma against folks with mental illness. So that stigma goes in a lot of different directions. And I think if there is anything, there is a lot in this report that New Hampshire is doing well. It is validating to see the ways in which they talk about, you know, networks of experts. We have our state's public health infrastructure. We have a governor's commission, a children's behavioral health collaborative, a commission on youth suicide in the state, all very vibrant and active, a commitment to evidence-based practice. But the one piece of this report I think that is, I think, groundbreaking and that we should be collectively thinking about is that it finally puts a stake in the ground that all of these issues are interrelated. Mm-hmm. And no matter which issue you might care about most, you will not achieve success unless we deal with the whole person, even so far as not just separating out substance abuse and mental illness, but the extent to which it identifies early trauma in childhood, family toxic stress, the opportunity gap, jobs, and economic development challenges, for which our state has many. And we see ourselves in conversations where there's a conversation around the future of the New Hampshire economy over here, there's a conversation about the substance abuse epidemic over here, and a conversation around mental illness somewhere else. And I think a report like this calls on us to take all of those conversations and begin them at once. It was one of the reasons why our foundation a couple of years ago launched an initiative called New Hampshire Tomorrow, where we are looking, talking with stakeholders across communities and with nonprofits about issues of early childhood, family youth supports, substance abuse, and jobs and pathways to career. Because if we want a healthy future for our state, you have to address all these issues at once. And continuing to silo them will eventually create roadblocks where we're not going to get any farther.
Go ahead, Ann.
And I agree with Tim. I think we're doing a fantastic job addressing each of these issues. Another area that I think needs to come together for these three issues is the idea of family supports, family education around substance and mental health issues and suicide risk. And just like Derek, thank you for being here today, Derek, just like Derek talked about, the power of lived experience, the power of peer supports in recovery. I think that is, we do a very good job here in this state with those three issues. But as Derek's story talks about with him as a person, is those three issues impacted his life in very significant ways all at once. So it's not, it is not viable, and it is not efficient to be able to focus only on one to the exclusion of the others.
I want to remind our listeners that you can join us. The number for you to be part of our conversation today in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email from Sarah in Portsmouth who says, it's surprising that New Hampshire ranks highly in national polls about the best places to raise a family, and at the same time is ranked fourth for addiction, suicide, and the longevity issues you were raising in this morning's show. Do your guests have any ideas about why our state seems to embody such disparate rankings? And another email, person didn't give a name, who has a similar question. What is it about New Hampshire that makes it so vulnerable? More than Vermont or Maine or Massachusetts? Seems hard to believe. This is a question that I have asked myself a gazillion times. You know, we're a relatively wealthy state. We have a low poverty rate. A lot of the other issues that some states have, we don't seem to have here. I just wonder what you think, Derek. Why New Hampshire?
I'll tell you this. I lived in Alabama. I've lived in New Orleans. I've lived in Georgia. And I've lived in New Hampshire. And something that I've noticed is very different about New Hampshire and New England in general is we have kind of this mentality of being of not socializing, you know, the youth. And, you know, I go to a lot of these. I lived in North Conway and Laconia. I live in now. And there's not a lot of things to do for kids, you know, who especially teenagers, to socialize and for activities. There's a lot of things like, you know, school things, but there's not a lot of, like, places. When I was a kid, we used to have, like, it was like a it was a skate park where people would go and hang out and stuff like that. And you know, I think there's skateboarding. Yeah. And but what I've noticed is that you know there's a sort of disconnect with people who they aren't as social. You know, living in the South, people invite everyone over to dinner. There's, you know, gatherings. There's all this stuff. And in New Hampshire, I think a lot of people are very standoffish.
It's that New England reserve.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think because of it, you know, and also a lot of people don't talk about their problems. They're not open with other people about what's going on at home. And so because of that, you know, there's so many people that are sort of left by the wayside. You know, when you have a problem, you don't talk about it, and it snowballs. And at least in my opinion, that's what I see going on in New Hampshire.
Well, and it's real interesting. And again, two people emailing Tim saying, you know, why New Hampshire? And I would have liked to have asked John Auerbach that question, too. But, you know, we're relatively wealthy, low poverty rate, you know, a clean state, good schools. You know, what's going on?
I have to agree with Derek. I think a lot of it has to do with how we congregate and come together as a community. I think as well, you know, there is a strength in, and I was raised in New Hampshire, so I can say it. There's a strength in that live free or die gestalt that defines us as citizens. But there's a downside to that too. And that is that very often when things go awry in one's personal life, sometimes those aren't talked about. We don't express those. And humans generally sometimes have difficulty asking for help. That happens everywhere, not just here. But I think when you have generations of unchecked substance use and mental illness that has flown under the radar, it's been held close to the vest by the individual, by the family, not been talked about in the community, I think you again create this snowball where eventually we get to where we are right now. You know, having sat in the legislature for almost a decade, engaging in conversation with policymakers about these issues, the last several years have been stunning in terms of even political will to address them. But that correlates in my experience with seeing at about the same time members of the legislature talking about, well, this happened in my family. A former student of mine died of an overdose. This happened to a neighbor. That personal experience has now come to the fore in a way it didn't used to. And I think having grown up here, it has to do with a lot of that, how we define community, as Derek spoke about, which I think is all the more reason why the ideas around building community, creating networks, bringing in stakeholders, like this report suggests, is so important. Because it's not actually the silos of the issues are one thing, but how we silo ourselves from one another and from our own stories and truth. Because I think there is that tendency to not in my backyard, it's not in my family, it's not an issue. And yet I think this report suggests, as our current experience in the opioid and mental health crisis are suggesting, these are our issues. These are your issues, whether they're happening within your personal social environment or not.
So there's cultural issues that you guys have explained. Also, Anne, for a long time, I have heard that it's very difficult for some people to get mental health treatment, even if they do break out of that, you know, I can do this on my own mentality that Derek talked about. And maybe even more difficult to get substance abuse treatment. This report says 1 in 10 people nationally get the substance abuse treatment they need. Does that sound like New Hampshire, or are we doing better than that?
I think Tim and Derek hit it on the head. I think we're talking about isolated individuals right within isolated communities. And when you look at the dynamics, certainly of drug overdose deaths, alcohol deaths, and suicide deaths in our state as well as in our country, the gender difference between males and females is huge. Oftentimes up to 4 times the amount of males impacted by these issues with tragic outcomes compared to females. So you take the isolated characteristics that both Derek and Tim talked about. You talk about the stigma and the access or the not accessing services and care and not talking about those kinds of issues. And it puts us right there along with Wyoming, West Virginia, and New Mexico.
All right. After a short break, we will talk more about what a resilience strategy might look like here in the Granite State, including what's already happening. Thank you for those emails. We'll take more of your questions and comments after a short break. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org, and we'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, a new national report examines the connection between substance abuse and suicide and predicts that in the upcoming decade, the Granite State will have among the country's highest increase in deaths from suicide, drug, and alcohol abuse. Pretty sobering numbers, but the report also talks about a resilience strategy, and we're going to turn to that in just a moment. The number for you to join us with your comments, questions, and of course, personal experiences, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. Tim Rourke is with us. He's director of substance use disorders grant making at the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation, chair of the Governor's Commission on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Prevention, Treatment, and Recovery. Ann Douglas is with us, community educator, prevention specialist for NAMI NH, along with Derek Hughes, a volunteer for NAMI's In Our Own Voices speaker series. Derek has told us his story. He's been in recovery since 2007. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. And let's go to Todd first, all of you. Todd's joining us from Amherst. Hi, Todd. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks. Good discussion. I think my comment was I agree with everything they've been saying about, you know, intervening with kids and families, and that's important. But we also have to kind of look at, we've become a very drug-tolerant and now drug-endorsing society. And, you know, I'm always having to explain to my kids, well, that's the state liquor store over there. Now when I go in the mall, they see vaping stores, and I have to say, well, those are people in there who are kind of addicted to nicotine. So it's very pervasive, and the state is very dependent on addiction dollars. They resist, our legislators resist any attempt to curb alcohol sales or tobacco sales. And I think they've been duped by the marijuana industry now into thinking that they're going to have this windfall of more money if they can get us addicted to marijuana.
Well,
and I think that's an overriding issue.
Yeah, Todd, thank you so much for the call. So, Tim, I know this is something you've talked about a lot. You know, on the one hand, we say, wow, we've got all these addiction problems. On the other hand, please go to the state liquor store. Concord has gone from having, I think, you know, no vaping shops to having, I don't know, 7 or 10. I've sort of lost count. And then there's the issue of legalizing marijuana. So what do you think? Here's Todd. He's trying to send out these messages, but he feels like he's not getting a lot of help from the state.
He is right. And I think that we have, you know, and I, again, with thanks to Derek for sharing his story, you know, as Derek alluded to, and as a number of people in recovery who share their stories, remind us, issues of addiction and mental health are children's diseases. They appear early in life, and many, many people in recovery share stories around the ways in which marijuana and alcohol were a part of that. I think we have a bit of a reckoning as a state in terms of thinking about how we stand for true youth prevention and resiliency. It is difficult at times when you've got challenges around treatment access for both mental illness and substance abuse to continue to maintain a focus on the fact these are both preventable illnesses and that there are mental health promotion strategies, substance abuse prevention strategies, and stakes in the ground that we can put to establish norms in communities that can reduce youth substance abuse and make it easier to early identify people who are struggling and get them help. And I think we are conflicted sometimes when there is this notion that you can profit off the sales and make revenue on that. Our state loses over $1 billion a year simply due to the overconsumption of alcohol.
And never mind everything else.
And we made $660 million last year on the sale of alcohol. So from a profit loss statement, I'm not entirely sure that we're getting what we need. There are prevention reasons why being a control state, having the state regulate alcohol is is helpful, because there are some problems around alcohol access for youth we do not have in New Hampshire because we regulate. So I am not anti-regulation of alcohol. But I do think the idea that making drugs more accessible, whether it be marijuana or loosening of alcohol policies under the guise of being able to produce revenue for the state, is simply foolish and completely ignores the public health outcomes that are known and are demonstrated in this report if we don't steer towards a more prevention-focused approach.
And go ahead.
I thank you, Todd, for calling in, because in the report, there is a need to improve how the country views and manages pain. And it also indicates that people need physical, emotional, and mental healing. And I think Todd nailed it on the head when he talked about all of these issues. Yes, we have an opiate crisis here in the state, in the country, but like Tim just said, it's an addiction crisis. It is not just about opiates.
Thank you, Todd, so much for the call. And let's go to Concord. Tom is on the air. Welcome, Tom. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you, Laura? Thank you so much for taking my call, and my greetings to my good friends, Ann and Tim. I'm the recently retired chief medical examiner, and I've spoken with Laura on the air about this very issue before, and I share the incredible enthusiasm that Ann and Tim have for this sort of integrated report. But the reason I'm calling is to just address something that Derek said that really sort of resonated with me, and that's the lack of youth services. And I And with all due respect to Derek, would take just the littlest bit of an issue with that, because we have a tremendous number, I think, of youth-serving organizations in New Hampshire, whether they be the Boys and Girl Scouts, the Boys and Girls Clubs. There are any number of faith-based youth organizations. But the flip side of that is exactly what Derek said, and that is that tendency to rugged individualism and not joining things. But if we could just get over that hump, all of these programs are excellent youth-serving programs. And while I realize just say no is oversimplifying the matter, and it's much, much, much more complex than that, certainly being plugged into a vibrant and active youth-serving organization with high values can serve as somewhat of an inoculant to that.
Yeah, it's tough.
And just wanted to make
speaking
of
the mother of two teenagers, it's one thing to have it there. It's the other thing to get them to go. I want to ask Derek about your comment in a minute. But Tom, as you said, you're the former chief medical examiner for the state, just retired recently, right?
September, yes.
Yeah, okay. So what are your broader thoughts on this report and what Ann called, you know, despair deaths predicted to go way up here in New Hampshire? Suicide, drugs, and alcohol. Entirely preventable.
It's a two-sided coin, obviously. The fact that those deaths are likely to occur in the short term is tragic. But the hope here is, as both of your guests have pointed out, is the resiliency piece, and secondarily, the fact that the silos are coming down. I really think for the first time, at least in my professional life, I'm seeing a genuine cross-pollination going on here. We've talked about it for 30 years, but with a report like this that puts it in the forefront, to have these three elements all talking together, and if you add to that, you know, education and law enforcement, I think that's the big plus in a report like this, to really focus our attention on a multidisciplinary attack on this public health disaster.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for calling in. I really appreciate it.
For having me.
Derek, about the point of and you spoke to this so well. You know, you felt like when you were 13, you had this mental illness. You weren't really sure what it was. You felt kind of like you couldn't relate to anybody. Did your parents, did your teachers, did others in the community try to kind of reach you in ways that they thought might be helpful, either through offering some sort of intervention for the mental illness you're struggling with, or through some kind of community organization? I just wonder what attempts were made to reach you and how hard you were to reach.
Sure. You know, one of the things that makes programs like Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, any kind of 12-step program so successful is that there's a sort of feeling of you know, family when you're around other people who are dealing with the same struggles that you are. And I think as a child, that's something that can be a little tough. And there are great programs. I agree with you that, you know, I was actually in Boy Scouts. I went to the Boys Club when I was in middle school. I lived in Haverhill, Massachusetts, and went to the Boys Club. And they're great programs. But when you have someone who is dealing with mental illness and just kind of butting into that in their own, you know, in their self, you know, learning about who you are and what you're dealing with, there's a feeling of disconnect from you and the other, so, quote unquote, and I'm doing air quotes here, normal people or normal kids. And so it's hard to kind of get in, you know, to get acclimated to those kind of things when you're feeling different. So one of the things that I think would be great to have here in New Hampshire is, and I'm not sure if it exists because I'm not, you know, I don't know every program and everything that's going on, but what I think would personally be helpful is something where you could take kids who are dealing with, you know, maybe autism or other mental illnesses that they're dealing with, and putting them, you know, giving them an opportunity to kind of, you know, group together and have activities and things like that where they can feel a part of, kind of like when you're an adult and you can go to an AA program and be around other people who are dealing with the same struggles you are, to be a youth and to be dealing with other kids who are going through the same struggles and to feel a part of. I think that would, you know, and there could be great sharing between family and friends of those people to learn how we can, you know, better serve those, that community. I think that would be really helpful here in New Hampshire.
Go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, to Derek's point, he's right, and there are some pockets of work where that's being done. You know, there's a great program that's been launched at the Boys and Girls Club of Nashville called Camp Mariposa. It's a national initiative started by a group called the Moyer Foundation, where they're engaging in a year-long daily programming plus weekend retreats targeting young people who have lost a parent to a substance abuse overdose. So right there at the heart of that moment where there's real access to trauma, those young people are getting a chance to come together with that shared experience in a safe environment with trusted adults. And I think that there are other examples of that all around the state, as well as programs, you know, youth serving programs that have really been stepping up and thinking about how do they modify and adapt their programs, recognizing that they are having an increase of young people coming in the door, either directly struggling with issues such as what Derek spoke of, or are coming from families where there is this kind of toxic stress. So we see organizations looking at their programming, bringing in behavioral health coaches to help consult their staff on how to make sure their programs are centered in a way that recognizes some of these risk factors. You know, and I also want to say that while certainly there are organizations and youth-serving organizations play a role, you cannot underestimate the power of a non-parental adult in the life of a child. Mentorship programs, big brothers, big sisters, or even what you do for your neighbors. You know, as I said, I grew up here and was involved in youth programs as a teenager. And one of the adults that is key to my life is Anne, who's sitting right here, who has known me since I was a teenager. And it's that kind of connection with positive adults, either in institutions and organizations that are gathering you with other peers, or that one-on-one relationship you build with a neighbor or you build with your neighbor's kid, that is so influential in helping to stem some of these risk factors you see in this report.
Here's an email from Sheila that I want to share with you because it raises a question that we haven't really hit on the head yet. Sheila says, I'm 70 years old. I've worked with young people who used, I'm assuming, drugs since 1968. I do not see that things will improve unless those who cause it pay for it. If the alcohol industry, prescriptive drug industry, physicians who prescribe opiates develop and pay for recovery centers with no tax breaks, there is no reason to expect any positive change in our situation. Sheila says, the sad state of affairs is that our nation has placed money above all else. We will see more use, abuse, and death until those industries are held responsible. We haven't really talked, Anne, that much about money and, you know, treatment, can be expensive. Sometimes insurers, even if you're lucky enough to have insurance, they cut you off from mental health visits. They don't want to pay for the fullness of substance abuse treatment. Derek talked about, you know, great 30-day program, but after he got out, that's when people are often the most vulnerable. So let's talk about the money. Where is it going to come from and who's going to shell it out?
For my part, I would say that this National Resilience Strategy is a wake-up call to all of us to talk about an integrated, comprehensive, as John said, multi-pronged approach. I think money and access to care that we've talked about earlier today, I think that is important, as Sheila is pointing out. But I don't think it's the only thing we need to focus on, because I think that has gotten us nowhere on focusing on just this answer or just this answer. I think we have to look at the whole, all of the contributing issues together. And one of the things I wanted to say, because I do think money and insurance and access to care is important, but I also think supports for families who are families and individuals who are struggling with these issues in isolation and disconnectedness, the way that Derek has so eloquently talked about, I think that's key. And we know about 12-step groups like Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous and support groups for Al-Anon and family members. And one of the things I think it's important, because it's a very big strength here in New Hampshire, we have family support groups for families who are struggling with their own or a family member's untreated or treated mental health issues all over the state.
Are people accessing that, though? Because given what this report says, it doesn't sound like things are going so well.
No, but I think we have to get the word out, because everybody in recovery knows about 12-step groups. And yet on the NAMI New Hampshire website, we have support groups for lost survivors of suicide. We have support groups for families and individuals who feel that disconnect in their lives due to these mental health, substance use, or suicide risk issues.
It kind of gets to what you said earlier, Derek. You know, it's there, but you feel disconnected and you don't access it.
Yeah. I think, you know, there's definitely, you know, we have a lot more, we're a lot more educated on programs like AA and NA and things like that, but there's not enough talk about, you know, things, you know, these other programs, and they're few and far between.
Before
and I think,
you get to that point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we need to definitely strengthen that, the access to those programs, you know, and talk about them more with people.
Go ahead, Tim. Last word.
I was going to say, I think, you know, there are a lot of free resources, communities coming together to deal with these issues. Yes, there are funding issues. And I think both from an insurance standpoint as well as a state funding standpoint, and I think it just requires our continued vigilance and being clear that there are, as this report suggests, while there's a lot of bad news potentially, there are solutions. And all we need to do as a state is commit ourselves to working differently and leveraging resources where needed, because it's not as though we don't know what works. It's indicated in this report.
All right, all of you. We have run out of time. I want to thank everybody very much for being here. Tim Rourke, Ann Douglas, Derek Hughes, great to have you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.